popcorn and peanut scraps left under the seats. Cronkite was amazed at their timing. How did they know it was the ninth inning? If you saw the city from this view, seagull view, way up high, what would it look like? It would be quiet and peaceful. Families in their homes, the blue-gray color of televisions flickering, a single golden light in the kitchen, sidewalks empty but for the occasional stray cat, whole motionless blocks. And he imagined soaring over it and noting that everywhere in Chicago that is not the few acres surrounding the Conrad Hilton Hotel is the most peaceful place in the world right now. And maybe that is the story. Not that thousands are protesting, but that millions are not. Maybe to achieve the balance CBS is looking for, they should take a crew to the northern Polish neighborhoods and western Greek neighborhoods and southern black neighborhoods and film nothing happening. To show how this protest is a pinprick of light in a much larger and gathering darkness. Would this make sense to the TV audience? That a thing like a protest expands and draws everything into it? He wants to tell his audience that the reality they are seeing on television is not reality. Imagine a single drop of water. That's the protest. Now put that drop of water into a bucket. That's the protest movement. Now drop that bucket into Lake Michigan. That's reality. But old Cronkite knows the danger of television is that people begin seeing the entire world through that single drop of water. How that one drop refracts the light becomes the whole picture. For many people, whatever they see tonight will cement in place everything they think about protest and peace and the 60s. And he feels, pressingly, that it's his job to prevent this closure. But how to say it right? 21. Sebastian leads her by the hand out of the small makeshift jail and into a completely gray and anonymous cinder block hallway. A police officer hurries out of a room and Fade jerks back at the sight of him. "It's okay," says Sebastian. "Come on." The cop walks right by, nodding as he goes. They pass through a set of double doors at the end of the hall and into a space decorated lavishly. Plush red carpet, wall sconces emitting a golden glow. White walls with ornate trim that suggests French aristocracy. Faye sees a sign on one of the doors and understands that they're in the basement of the Conrad Hilton Hotel. "How did you know I was arrested?" she says. He turns to her and flashes a rascally smile. "Grapevine." He takes her through the belly of the hotel, passing police and reporters and hotel staff, all of them hustling to somewhere, all of them looking grim and serious. They reach a set of thick metal exterior doors guarded by two more cops, who nod at Sebastian and allow him to pass. And in this way, they are delivered into a loading dock, and then into the alleyway, into the open air. The sound of the protest reaches them here as an indistinct howl that seems to be coming from all directions at once. "Listen," Sebastian says, cocking his ear to the sky. "Everybody's here." "How did you do that?" Faye says. "We walked right by those cops. Why didn't they say something? Why didn't they stop us?" "You have to promise me," he says, grabbing her by the arms. "You'll never mention this, not to anyone." "Tell me how you did it." "Promise, Faye. You cannot breathe a word about it. Tell them I bailed you out, that's it." "But you didn't bail me out. You had a key. How did you have a key?" "Not a word. I'm trusting you. I did you a favor, and now your favor back to me is to keep this a secret, okay?" Faye considers him for a moment and understands that he is not the single entendre student radical she had taken him for. He has mysteries. He has layers. She knows something about him no one else does, has power over him no one else can wield. Her heart swells for him. He's a kindred spirit, she thinks, someone else whose life is hidden and vast. She nods. Sebastian smiles and takes her hand and leads her to the end of the alley and into the sun. And as they round the corner, she sees the police and the military and the blockade and beyond the blockade, the great teeming mass in the park. No longer shadows on the wall, she sees them now in detail and color. The soft baby blue police uniforms, the bayonets of the National Guardsmen, the jeeps whose front bumpers are coils of razor wire. The crowd moving as a surging beast presently surrounding and taking over the statue of Ulysses S. Grant, opposite the Conrad Hilton, the 10-foot-tall Grant on his 10-foot-tall horse, the crowd climbing up the horse's bronze legs and onto its neck and rump and head, one brave youth continuing up, climbing Grant himself, standing atop Grant's huge broad shoulders, teetering but erect, raising his arms in double peace signs above his head in defiance of the police, who are right now noticing this and are ambling over to pull him down. This will not end well for him, but the audience cheers anyway, for he is the bravest among them, the tallest thing in the whole park. Fay and Sebastian slip by the mayhem and into the anonymity of the crowd. 22. Officer Brown continues to bust heads, and around him the cops have removed their badges and name tags. They have pulled the visors of their riot helmets over their faces. They are anonymous. The news is not happy about this development. "Police are beating people with impunity," the journalists say on CBS News. They demand transparency, accountability. They say the police have removed their badges and hidden their faces because they know what they're doing is illegal. Comparisons are made to the Soviets rolling into Prague earlier this year, running down and overwhelming the poor Czechs. The Chicago PD is acting like that, the journalists say. It's Czechoslovakia West. Chicago is a word it does not take long for someone clever to make up. "In America, the government is accountable to the people, not the other way around," says a constitutional law scholar sympathetic to the anti-war movement on the subject of the anonymous police. Officer Brown is wailing away, the most excited among all the cops to really clunk the hippies in vital and deadly places, the skull, the chest, even the face. He was the first to appear minus a badge or a name tag, and all the officers around him have lowered their visors and removed their name tags too, but not because they want to join him in his frenzy. Rather the opposite. They see he's going a little nuts now, and they can't really stop him, and the cameras are clicking away, attracted as they are to any moment of police brutality. And so all the nearby officers tuck away their badges and lower their visors because this fucker is asking to lose his pension, but they sure as shit won't lose theirs. 23. Cronkite knows this is his punishment for editorializing. Doing this interview with the mayor and serving up these cream puff questions, it's because Cronkite called the Chicago police a bunch of thugs. And he did it live on the air. Well, that's what they are, and that's what he told his producers, who said he'd made a judgment, which was wrong, since it was up to the viewers to decide whether the police were or were not thugs. He countered that he'd made an observation, which is what they paid him for, to observe and report. They said he'd expressed an opinion. He said sometimes an observation is inseparable from an opinion. This was not convincing to his producers. But the police were out there cracking open skulls with nightsticks. They were taking off their badges and name tags and lowering the visors on their riot helmets to become faceless and unaccountable. They were beating kids senseless. They were beating members of the press, photographers and reporters, breaking cameras and taking film. They even punched poor Dan Rather right in the solar plexus. What do you call people like that? You call them thugs. His producers still were not convinced. Cronkite thought the police were beating innocent people. The mayor's office told them the police were protecting innocent people. Who was right? It reminded him of that old story. A king once asked a group of blind men to describe an elephant. To one of them, he presented the head of the elephant. To another, he presented an ear, a tusk, the trunk, the tail, and so on, saying, "This is an elephant." Afterward, the blind men could not agree on what an elephant really looked like. They argued with each other, saying, "An elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that." They fought each other with their fists, and the king watched the whole spectacle and was delighted. Probably as delighted as the mayor is right now, old Cronkite imagines as he lobs him another softball question about the well-trained and heroic and completely supported by the public Chicago PD. And the gleam in the mayor's eye is just about the most insufferable thing old Cronkite has ever seen, that sparkle the mayor gets when he's beaten a worthy opponent. And Cronkite is a worthy opponent indeed. One imagines there were lengthy phone calls between the mayor's office and the CBS producers. Much debating, many threats, some kind of compromise was reached, and thus old Cronkite stands here extolling the virtues of men he called thugs not 3 hours ago. You gotta eat a lot of shit in this job sometimes. 24. Near the end of the day, just before sunset, there's a lull in the trauma. Police hang back, sort of stunned and shamefaced. They have stopped raising their nightsticks and raised their bullhorns instead. They ask the protesters to please leave the park. The protesters watch them and wait. The city has the feeling of an injured child. A toddler will knock its head, and after a slight delay during which all the chaotic sense signals resolve into pain, it begins to wail. The city is inside that delay now, between injury and lamentation, between cause and effect. The hope is that the lull will persist. This is Allen Ginsberg's hope, anyway, that once the city gets a taste of this peace, it won't want to fight again. Grand Park is calm now, and he's stopped his chanting and oming long enough to move about the beautiful crowd. In his bag, he always carries two things, the Tibetan Book of the Dead and a silver Kodak retina reflex camera. It's the Kodak he reaches for right now, the thing he's used to document all the luminous moments of his life. And this moment is luminous indeed. The gathered protesters all sitting and laughing and singing songs of joy, and waving homemade flags with their cleverest slogans hand-painted on them. He wants to make a poem out of it all. His Kodak is a worn-out second-hand thing, but it's sturdy, its guts still sound. He loves its metal girth in his hand, the black grips rippled like alligator skin, the mechanical gear noises as he advances the film, even the Made in Germany sticker stamped so confidently on the front. He snaps a photo of the gathered crowd. He walks among them, their bodies parting for him, their faces open to his. And when he sees a familiar face, he stops and kneels, one of the student leaders he remembers, the olive-skinned pretty one. He's sitting with a pleasant young girl with big round glasses who rests her head on his shoulder, exhausted. Faye and Sebastian, they lean against each other like lovers. Alice sits behind them. Ginsberg raises his camera to his eye. The young man gives him a wry, sidelong smile that just about breaks his heart. The shutter clicks. Ginsberg stands and smiles sadly. He moves on, swallowed by the vast crowd, the incandescent day. 25. The poet walks away, and Alice taps Faye on the shoulder and winks at her and says, "So, did you two have a good time last night?" Because, of course, Alice doesn't know what happened. And so Faye explains to her about the mysterious cop who arrested her and the night she spent in jail. How Faye doesn't even know the cop's name or what she did to deserve all that. How the cop told her to vacate Chicago immediately, and Alice is stricken because she knows right away it's Officer Brown. Of course it's him. But she can't tell Faye. Not right now. How could she possibly admit in the middle of this crowd of protesters throwing angry insults at the police that she'd been having a pretty passionate love affair with one of these very cops? There's no way. Alice hugs Faye tightly. "I'm sorry," she says, "but don't worry. Everything will be all right. You aren't going anywhere. I'll stick by you no matter what." And that's when the police gather on the edges of the park and announce via bullhorns, "You have 10 minutes to clear this area," which is a laughable request, because there's like 10,000 people here. "Do they really expect us all to leave?" Alice asks. "Probably not," Sebastian says. "What are they going to do?" Faye says, looking around at the great stubborn mass of humanity occupying the park. "Move us all by force?" Turns out, this is exactly what they're going to do. It begins with a soft pop of compressed air, a gentle sounding and almost musical burst as a canister of tear gas is launched into the park. And for those who watch it come, there's a strange delay between seeing it and understanding what it means. It soars in its parabola up into a sky far too pretty to accommodate it, and it seems to hang in the air above them for a split second, a north star to some of them, their compasses now pointing at this thing, this strange new flying fact, which then begins its descent, and the yelling and the screaming begin roughly now, as the people in the projectile's landing zone start to accept what is coming right at them and understand this is the de facto end of their sit-in. The canister is already leaking its contents, leaving this tail of orange gas, a comet on a collision course. And when it lands, it thuds into the grass like a golf ball and kicks up the turf and ignites. It spins and spews jets of toxic smoke as more little pops are heard, coming from the direction of the Conrad Hilton, and one or two more flying bombs come hurtling into the crowd, and this is how fast relative peace and order can fall into madness. The crowd starts running, and the police start running, and almost everybody in the park is simultaneously crying. It's the gas, the way it attacks your eyes and throat, how it feels like burning oil splattered right into your pupil, the way you can't keep your red swollen eyes open without the pain, no matter how much you rub them, and the coughing as sudden and urgent as drowning, that reflexive hacking that bypasses all willpower. People are crying and spitting and running anywhere there is not gas, which presents a basic problem of volume. The gas was fired, purposefully or accidentally, it's not known, so that it landed behind most of the crowd, which means the only way to avoid the misery of the gas is to run the other way, in the direction of Michigan Avenue and the Conrad Hilton and the vast police blockades. And so the volume problem is that there are way more people wanting to be on Michigan Avenue than there is currently space on Michigan Avenue for these people. It's your unstoppable force meeting its immovable object, the body mass of 10,000 protesters running headlong into the teeth of the Chicago PD. And Sebastian with them, towing Faye by the hand, and Alice watches them and understands this is exactly the wrong way to go, that the only direction where there are no police is back into the tear gas itself, the cloud that hugs the ground like an orange fog. She calls out to them to stop, but her voice, raw and ragged from the earlier chanting and now blown to bits by the gas, cannot be heard above the roar and screams of the crowd, all of them running, bouncing into one another, scattering. She watches Sebastian and Faye as the crowd collapses around them and she loses them in the mass. She wants to go after them, but something holds her back. Fear, probably. Fear of the police. One of them in particular. She will go to the dorm and wait for Faye, she decides. And if Faye doesn't come back, she'll stop at nothing to find her, which is a comfortable lie, she tells herself, to get out of the immediate situation. She will, in fact, never see Faye again. She doesn't know this yet, but she senses it, and she stops running. She turns back toward the protest, the park. And at that moment, Faye is tugging on Sebastian's arm because Alice isn't with them. Faye stops and turns around. She looks back at where they came from. She hopes Alice's face will pop out of the chaos, but between the two of them is an orange cloud of gas. It might as well be a concrete wall or a continent. "We need to go," says Sebastian. "Wait," says Faye. Faces fly by her, none of them Alice's. People clip her shoulders, dodge her, keep running. Alice is on the other side of the gas now. She can see the lake. She runs to it and splashes her face to calm the sting of the gas, and she slinks northward along the shore, where, to avoid drawing attention to herself, she ditches her favorite sunglasses and army jacket in the sand, and pulls her hair back and tries to look for all intents and purposes like a normal, bourgeois, law-abiding kid. And this effectively puts an end to her protest career forever. "We need to go now," says Sebastian. And so Faye agrees, for Alice is gone. 26. Hubert H. Humphrey, in the top-floor presidential suite shower, digs under his fingernails with the hotel's complimentary bar of Dove soap, which during his lengthy shower has slivered down from its original kidney-shaped girth. The agents keep popping their heads in. "You okay in there, Mr. Vice President, sir?" He understands there's much to do and little time to do it, and taking a 90-minute shower was not exactly on his campaign manager's itinerary. Still, he would have been worthless had he not gotten that stink off. His fingers are beyond pruned and into this super-saturated territory, where his skin looks like an Afghan draped loosely over his actual skin. The mirror is opaque and slate-gray by now in the humid, dense air. "Yes, I'm fine," he tells the agent. Only he's not fine, he realizes as he speaks, because there's a sudden tickle in his throat, a slight scratchy pain behind his Adam's apple. He hasn't spoken in an hour and a half, and now that he's spoken he feels it, the first leading edge of illness. He He tests his throat, his precious and golden throat, his vocal cords and lungs, these bits of him that are all he has to give as he addresses the country and accepts the nomination for president in a few days' time. He verbalizes a few notes, just a little solfège, a little do-re-mi. And sure enough, he feels it. That spike of pain, that friction burn, that swelling on the soft palate. Oh, no. He turns the water off and towels himself dry and robes up and crashes into the suite's main conference area and announces that he needs vitamin C right now. When the group looks at him funny, he announces, "I may have a sore throat," with the kind of gravity a doctor might use to say, "The tumor is malignant." The agents look at each other uncomfortably. A few of them cough. One of them steps forward and says, "Probably not a sore throat, sir." "How would you know?" Triple H says. "I need vitamin C, and I need it right this goddamn second."
"Sir, it's probably the tear gas, Mr. Vice President, sir."
"What are you talking about?"
"Tear gas, sir. Your typical motivational weapon, sir. Used to disperse crowds nonviolently. Irritating to the eyes, nose, mouth, and yes, certainly, sir, the throat and lungs."
"Tear gas?"
"Yes, sir."
"In here?"
"Yes, sir."
"In my hotel suite?"
"It came from the park, sir. The police are using it on the demonstrators, and today, you see, we've got an easterly wind."
"At about 12 knots," adds another agent.
"Agreed, yes, thank you. A sturdy wind that pushed the gas back across Michigan Avenue and into the hotel and even, yes, up to the top floor. Our floor, sir."
Triple H can now feel his eyes watering and burning, that feeling like when you're standing over chopped onions. He walks to the suite's large front windows and looks out at the park, which is a chaos of running, terrified youths and pursuing cops in clouds of orange gas. "The police did this?"
he says. "Yes, sir."
"But don't they know I'm up here?"
And this is almost the breaking point for poor Hubert H.
This was supposed to be his convention, his moment. Why did this have to happen? Why does it always have to turn out like this? And suddenly he's 8 years old again, back in South Dakota. And Tommy Scrumpf is ruining his birthday party by having an epileptic fit right there on the kitchen floor. And the doctors take Tommy away, and the parents take their kids home still carrying the unopened presents that were supposed to be Hubert's. And a small, ungenerous part of him broke open that night, and he wept not that Tommy might die, but wishing that he would. And then he's 19 years old, and he's just finished his first year at college. And he's got good marks, and he likes it, college. He's good at it. And he's made friends and found a girl, and his life is finally shaping up, and that's when his parents tell him to come home because they're out of money. So he comes home. And then it's 1948, and he's just been elected to the United States Senate for the first time, and at that moment his father up and dies. And now here he is, about to be nominated for president, and all around him is fighting and tear gas and butchers and shit and death. Why does this always happen? Why does he have to pay for any triumph with sadness and blood? All his victories end in sorrow. In some ways, he's still that disappointed 8-year-old thinking bad things about Tommy Scrumpf. He feels the sting of that day all the way to his marrow, still. Why do the best things in life leave such deep scars? Which is exactly the kind of self-destructive, negative-type thinking the management consultants were brought in to fix. He repeats his confidence mantras. "I'm a winner." He cancels the order for the vitamin C. He gets dressed. Gets back to work. Sic transit gloria mundi. 27. Old Cronkite, listening to his right, leaning on his desk in a manner that plays on TV, is serious contemplation and the strong-willed constitution of a man whose job it is to deliver bad news to the country. Leaning like this, and cocking his head, and staring into the camera with a pained look on his face, the kind of father's, "this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you" look, and saying, "The Democratic Convention is about to begin." Then a long dramatic pause here for this next part to really sink in. "In a police state." Then adding, "There just doesn't seem to be any other way to say it." For the benefit of his producers, who he can imagine are right now shaking their heads in the control van at his blatant editorializing again. But something needs to be said for the benefit of the viewers who are at home and plainly not getting it. The CBS switchboard has been going nuts all day. The most calls they'd gotten since King was shot. "Well, sure," Cronkite said, "people are mad. The police are out of control." Yes, people are mad, his producers told him, but not mad at the police. They're mad at the kids, they said. They're blaming the kids. They're saying the kids are getting what they deserve. And it's true that certain protesters are not entirely, let's say, easy to like. They try to offend your sensibilities. They try to push your buttons. They are unkempt, unclean, but they are only a tiny part of the mass gathered right now outside the Hilton. Most of the kids out there look like normal kids, anybody's kids. Maybe they'd gotten themselves into something they didn't understand, swept up in something larger, but they aren't criminals, they aren't deviants, they aren't radicals or hippies. They probably just don't want to be drafted. They are probably just sincerely against the Vietnam War. And by the way, who isn't these days? But it turns out that for every poor kid shown getting his head drubbed by a nightstick, CBS gets 10 phone calls in support of the cop who held the stick. Reporters got gassed in the street and then came back to HQ to find a telegram from 1,000 miles away saying the reporters didn't understand what was really happening in Chicago. As soon as he heard this, old Cronkite knew he'd failed. They'd been covering the radicals and the hippies so much that now his viewers couldn't see past them. The gray areas had ceased to exist, and old Cronkite had two thoughts about this. First, anyone who thinks television can bring the nation together to have a real dialogue and begin to understand one another with empathy and compassion is suffering a great delusion. And second, Nixon is definitely going to win this thing. 28. It is bad planning on the part of the police to demand that protesters leave the park, but give them no obvious way to do so. It is no longer legal to assemble in the park, but it is also illegal to cross a police barricade, and the park is barricaded on all sides. So it's your classic double bind. Actually, the only place not barricaded is a spot on the eastern edge of the park by the lake, exactly where the tear gas landed, stupidly. So here they come, the protesters, because they have no other choice. There's nowhere else to go. The first of them flow onto Michigan Avenue and into the walls of the Conrad Hilton like runaway waves. They splash onto the concrete and brick, and they're pinned there as the police recognize that something has shifted in the rhetoric of the day. The stakes have changed. The protesters, with their numbers and their new desperation, now have the upper hand. And so the police push back, crush them into the walls of the hotel, and swing away. Sebastian and Faye are in there somewhere. He's squeezing her hand so hard it hurts, but she doesn't dare let go. She feels herself caught in this moving human river and pressed at all sides, and sometimes even lifted off her feet for a moment and carried. A sensation like swimming or floating before being dropped again, and the thing she's thinking about most right now is keeping her balance, staying on her feet, because these people are panicked, and this is what 10,000 panicked people look like wild animals, huge and insensate. If she falls, she'll be trampled. The terror she feels about this goes way beyond terror and into a kind of calm clarity. This is life or death. She squeezes Sebastian's hand harder. People run with handkerchiefs on their faces or with their shirts wrapped around their mouths. They cannot stand the gas. They cannot stay in the park. And yet it's becoming clear to them now that this was a mistake, too, going this way, because as they get closer to the safety of the dark city beyond Michigan Avenue, the spaces they can fill are getting smaller and smaller. They are being funneled by heavy equipment and fencing and barbed wire and lines of cops and National Guardsmen 30 deep. And Sebastian tries to get to the Hilton's front doors, but the crowd is too thick. The current too strong, and so they end up off target, carried to the side of the building instead, and up against the plate glass windows of the Haymarket Bar. That's where Officer Brown sees them. He's been watching the crowd looking for Alice. He's standing atop the back bumper of a U.S. Army troop carrier, several feet above everyone else, looking at the crowd, the baby blue helmets of the Chicago PD, en masse, like a colony of agitated poisonous mushrooms, it looks like, from up here. And then suddenly a face pops out of the crowd, over by the bar, a woman's face. And he feels a surge of optimism that it's Alice, because it's the first time all day he's had any flash of familiarity. And the film that's been running in his head, that Alice sees him clubbing hippies and thus recognizes him for the brutal man she's always wanted him to be, starts running again until the face resolves itself
and he realizes with crashing disappointment that it's not Alice he's seeing. It's Faye. Faye. The girl he arrested just last night, who should be in jail right this moment, who is the very reason Alice left him. Fucking bitch. He leaps into the crowd and unholsters his club. He presses forward, shoves his way toward the plate glass window Faye is trapped against. Between him and her are several lines of cops and a mass of stinking hippies trapped and flapping like tuna in a net. He shoulders his way through the crowd, saying, "Coming through! From behind!" And the cops are glad to let him go, because that's one more guy between them and the front line. And he's getting closer to the boundary between the cops and the protesters, a boundary visible by the nightsticks in the air coming down fast like a typewriter getting all jammed up in itself. The closer he gets, the harder it is to move. Everything seems to heave, like they are all part of one great sick animal. And at that moment, a squad of National Guardsmen, one of them carrying an actual flamethrower, though thankfully not using it, carves through the protesters on Michigan Avenue, effectively flanking them, cutting them off from the rest of the herd, and so this small group by the Conrad Hilton finds itself trapped. Police on one side, National Guard on the other, hotel walls behind them. There is nowhere for them to go. Faye is crushed against the plate glass window, her shoulder pressed hard into it. Any harder, she thinks, and it'll pop, the shoulder. She's looking into the Haymarket bar, through the window that seems to wobble and creak, and she sees two men in suits and black ties staring back at her. They sip their drinks. They seem to have no expression at all. Around her, protesters squirm and duck for cover. They get clubbed in the head, get jabbed in the ribs with the blunt end of a nightstick, and as they go down, they are dragged to paddy wagons, which seems to Faye preferable. Between a knock to the head and going to the paddy wagon, she'll take the wagon. But she can't even turn here, much less go to the ground, such as the tightness of the bodies pressing into her. She's losing hold of Sebastian's hand. There's someone between them now, another protester between Faye and Sebastian doing exactly what they're doing, which is to say, trying to flee, putting off the beating as long as possible. This is simple and irrational survival kicking in. There's nowhere to flee, yet they flee anyway. And Faye has to make a choice right now, because if she keeps holding on to Sebastian's hand like this, her elbow might break where this guy is pressing into it. Plus, she's such an easy target like this, her back to the cops. If she turned around, maybe she'd be able to duck out of the way of their wild swinging. So she makes the decision. She lets go of Sebastian's hand. She lets his sweaty fingers slide away, and as she does so, she feels him grasping for her harder, really clamping down, but it's no use. She's free. Her arm snaps back to her, and the man between them collapses into the plate glass window, which trembles at the impact and sounds a sharp crack like boots on ice, and she turns around. The first thing she sees is the cop bearing down on her. They lock eyes. It's the cop from last night, who arrested her at the dorm. His is the first face she sees in that way someone's face seems more illuminated when they're staring right at you. That face, that awful man who last night wouldn't look at her as she cried in the backseat of his police cruiser, and she pleaded with him and urged him to let her go, and she stared at his reflection in the rearview mirror, and he didn't say anything except, "You are a whore." And how he found her again. Here. Now. His face is psychotically calm. He swings his club quickly and emotionlessly. He looks like someone out trimming the grass, feeling nothing about it except that it needs to be done. And she looks at his big, brutal body and the strength with which he swings his nightstick, its speed as it dashes into heads and ribs and limbs, and she knows her plan to avoid a police beating by athletically dodging it was both naive and impossible. This man can do whatever he wants. She can't stop him. She is powerless. He is coming. And what she does here is try to get really small. It's the only thing she can think of, to become the smallest target she can. She tries to shrink into herself, draw in her arms and duck her head and bend at the knees and waist to get below the level of the people in front of her. A posture of supplication, it feels like. All her alarm bells are going off, and she feels the panic attack starting as it always does, with that iron weight in her chest like she's being squeezed from the inside. She thinks, "Please, not now,"
as the cop continues to punish whoever happens to interrupt his path to Faye. And the protesters yell, "Peace!" or "I'm not resisting!" And they hold up their hands, palms out, surrendering, but the cop clobbers them anyway, in the head, the neck, the belly. He's so close now. Only one person stands between him and Faye, a young, wiry man with a big beard and camo jacket, who is very quickly getting the message and trying his best to squirm away, and Faye's lungs are locking up, and she's feeling that head rush dizziness that makes her all trembly and unsteady, and her skin feels cold and wet, and the sweat erupts out of her so quickly as her forehead damp, while her mouth is chalk dry and gummy so that she can't even tell the cop not to do whatever he's going to do. All this happening as she watches him shove aside the camo jacket guy and press into the crowd so that he's within range of Faye. And he's trying to angle his body so he can get to her, trying to raise his weapon in all that human chaos, when from behind them they all hear two pops. Two light pops that sound like someone's hand beating the open end of an empty bottle. And before today, a sound like that would have had no meaning. But now, the protesters are all veterans at this, and they know. That sound means tear gas. Someone behind them has fired more tear gas. And the crowd reacts to this, the sound, and then the inevitable smoke cloud that erupts a second later, predictably. They panic and surge away from it, a wave of bodies that reaches Faye just as the cop lunges for her, and all of them, at the same time, crash into the plate glass window together. This, finally, proves too much for the window to bear. This is well beyond its tolerances. The window doesn't even really crack, so much as explode sharply everywhere all at once. And Faye and the cop and the great rush of protesters pushing themselves against it all collapse and tumble backward into the people and smoke and music of the Haymarket Bar. 29. The day has thus far been so unusual that it takes a moment for the patrons of the Haymarket Bar to recognize something has happened that is even more unusual. The plate glass window shatters and in tumble protesters and cops and great sharp shards of glass, and for a moment they simply watch this happening as if they're watching the television above the bar. They are mildly fascinated. They feel drawn to it, yet also separate from it. They are spectators, not participants. So for a few moments as the protesters and cops all wrestle around regaining their lost balance in this scrum of humanity on the black and white tiled Haymarket floor, people in the bar watch with a passive interest, like, "Wow. Neat. Wonder what'll happen next." What happens next is that the tear gas leaks in and the cops get extremely pissed off and pile through the new opening in the side of the bar and sprint from the lobby because the thing that was never supposed to happen in Chicago has now happened. The delegates and the protesters are in the same room together. Their orders were very clear on this point. The delegates were to be met at the airport right as they stepped off the plane, taken in police cars to the Hilton, taken in big buses with military-grade escorts to the amphitheater and back, shielded, bubbled, cut off from the hippies because the hippies are trying to disrupt and threaten our democracy, which is what the mayor said every day in the newspapers and on television. The protest leader's response that a democracy has ceased to be democratic when its representatives must be shielded from the people they represent went for the most part unreported and for sure unanswered by the mayor or his press office. Anyway, here they come, the police, red-faced and running, moving as quickly as allowed by jangling heavy utility belts full of weapons. And this is about the time that things get very real for the patrons of the Haymarket Bar. Coughing and crying suddenly because of the gas, clipped by running police or errant billy clubs, they realize they are not really spectators to this event. They are now part of it. This is how quickly the reality outside the bar penetrates and obliterates the reality inside the bar, with a simple pop of glass. The bar is now an extension of the street. The front lines have shifted. How long, they wonder, before the lines shift further? How long before their hotel rooms are at risk, their own homes, their families? For many of them, the protest was mild street theater until this moment, when they themselves are getting gassed. They think of bricks, perhaps someday, flying through their own windows. Or they think of their daughters growing up and getting seduced by bearded, long-haired, smoke-smelling men. And even the most pro-peace plank among them stand back and let the cops do their brutal work. So it's all chaos, in other words. Chaos and panic. Faye lands hard on her side and under several other bodies all clacking heads and jaws together, and she's seeing stars and fighting to regain the wind that was knocked from her when she landed on the floor. She tries to focus on little things, to see through the green-purple starry screen of her vision to the checkered floor, the bits and chunks of glass around her, some sliding like hockey pucks as they're kicked and battered by the melee now occupying the bar. It all feels very far away. She blinks. She shakes her head. She sees the feet of police as they run toward her, the feet of patrons as they run away. She runs her fingers over her own forehead and feels a lump the size of a walnut growing there. She remembers the cop who was a moment ago coming after her, and sees him lying face up, halfway in the bar, and halfway out. 30. He's not moving. He stares straight up. What he's seeing is the jagged edge of the plate glass window, what's left of it, about 8 feet above him, an equator in his field of vision. North of it is the tin ceiling of the Haymarket Bar. South, the sky, a hazy, vaporous dusk. When he fell, he twisted and turned and crashed down backward and felt a bolt of pain at the landing. He's lying perfectly still and thinking about what he feels now. Nothing is what he feels. Around him, police jump through the broken window and into the bar. He feels like he needs to tell one of them something, though he doesn't know what. Just that something doesn't feel right here. And he doesn't understand what's going on, but he senses that it's important. More important than the delegates or the hippies or the bar. He tries to speak to them as they leap around him, over him. His voice comes out small and thin. He says, "Wait." But none of them do. They crash into the bar where they yank hippies off the floor and eject them onto the street, where they club the hippies and maybe even a few delegates too, because it's dark in there and hard to tell the difference when you're swinging like that. 31. Sebastian has gotten to his feet and finds Faye on the floor and yanks her up by the arm. She's feeling lightheaded, queasy. She would like nothing better than to sit down at one of the Haymarket's comfortable-looking plush booths and sip some tea with honey, and then maybe sleep. Oh, my God, how she wants to sleep, even now, right here at the violent center of the world. She's still seeing stars. She must have hit her head pretty good. Sebastian pulls her, and she is compliant. She lets herself be pulled, not toward the front door where several of the other protesters are running, and not back out onto the street, but deeper into the bar, back to the farthest corner, where there's a payphone and a pair of bathrooms, and one of those silver swinging doors with the round window that leads into the kitchen. This is where they go, into the Hilton's industrial kitchen, which is currently in frenzied with room service orders, the guests at the hotel being terrified to leave the grounds and so getting all their meals on site, delivered. And dozens of white-aproned, white-hatted men stand over griddles that crackle with porterhouse steaks and filet mignon, over sandwich stations building hoagies of improbable height, over table services polishing wine glasses to a perfect smudgeless clarity. They see Sebastian and Faye, and they don't say a word. They keep on working. Not their problem. Sebastian ushers her through the loud and busy kitchen all the way past the grills with leaping fire and burners cooking sauces and pastas, past the dishwashing station and the dishwasher himself, his face in a cloud of steam, and beyond to the back door, through the door and into the trash area, the dumpster with its sharp sour milk and old chicken smells, and beyond that into the alley, away from Michigan Avenue, away from the noise and tear gas, and away, finally, from the Conrad Hilton Hotel. 32. Officer Brown is still on his back in the broken window well of the Haymarket Bar, and he's beginning to understand that he cannot feel his legs. He fell and he landed on something sharp and felt a stabbing pain near his kidney, and now he feels nothing. A spreading chill, a numbness. He tries to stand but cannot. He closes his eyes and he swears he's trapped under a car. That's how it feels. But when he opens his eyes again, there is nothing visibly trapping him.
Help,
he says to no one, to the air, at first quietly but then with more urgency.
Help!
The bar has been cleared of hippies by now, and the guests have all retreated to their rooms. The only people who remain in the bar are two Secret Service agents who amble up to him now and say,
"What seems to be the problem, officer?"
with a kind of light-hearted chumminess that disappears as soon as they try to help him get up, and can't, and their hands come away bloodied. At first, Brown thinks they've injured themselves on the broken glass beneath him. Then he realizes the blood is not theirs. That's his blood. He's bleeding. He's bleeding a lot. But he can't be bleeding. Because nothing hurts.
"I'm okay,"
he says to the one agent who has sat down next to him, one hand pressing firmly on Brown's chest.
"Sure thing, buddy. You're gonna be fine."
"Really? It doesn't hurt?"
"Uh-huh. You stay right where you are and don't move. We're getting you some help."
And Brown notices the other agent now speaking into a walkie-talkie about an officer down. "Send an ambulance immediately," and it's the way he says the word, "immediately," that makes Brown squeeze his eyes shut and say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Not to the agent above him, but to God. Or the universe. Or whatever karmic powers are out there right now deciding his fate. He apologizes to all of them. For his encounters with Alice, for cheating on his wife, for cheating on his wife in such an ugly way, in the dark, in alleyways, in his car. He's sorry he didn't have the will to stop it, nor the discipline, the self-control. He's sorry for this, and sorry that he's repenting only now, after it's too late, and he's aware of the spreading coldness in his lower half, and he senses, though he cannot feel, the sharp shard of plate glass window currently penetrating his spinal cord. And he's not sure what exactly has happened to him, but feels that whatever it is, he is sorry that it happened, that he deserved it.
33. Churches across Chicago have opened their sanctuaries as sanctuaries. Youths arrive, tear-gassed and beaten. They are given water, a meal, a cot. After the violence of the day, some of them almost weep at these small kindnesses. Outside, the riot has splintered, broken down into fragmented fighting and scuffles in the street. A few cops chasing kids into bars and restaurants, into and out of the park. It's not safe to be out there right now, and so youth show up in ragged pairs at places like this. Old St. Peter's on Madison Street, downtown. They don't even gossip with the other protesters, all of them having endured roughly the same day. They sit penitently. Priests give them bowls of warmed canned soup, and they say, "Thank you, Father," and they really mean it. The priests give them warm washcloths for their eyes, red from the gas. Faye and Sebastian sit in the front pew, quiet and uncomfortable because there's so much to say, and they don't know how to say it. They stare at the front altar instead, the elaborately inscribed stone and wood altarpiece of St. Peter's in the Loop. Stone angels and stone saints and a stone Jesus hanging on a concrete cross, his head looking straight down, two stone disciples below him, just under his armpits, one looking up at him with a face of anguish, the other looking at his own feet, ashamed. Faye touches the lump on her head. It has stopped hurting for the most part and now feels simply fascinating, this strange alien growth, this hard marble under her skin. Maybe if she plays with this thing, she can resist asking the questions she is dying to ask. Questions that have begun forming these last 20 minutes as they've sat here, out of danger now, as she's collected her thoughts and begun looking at the evening rationally and logically. These questions have settled upon her. "Faye, listen," says Sebastian. "Who are you, really?" she says, because she cannot resist asking, no matter how fascinating her bump feels. Sebastian smiles a sad smile. He looks at his shoes. "Yeah, about that." "You knew your way around those buildings," Faye says. "How did you know that? And that key, you had the key to my cell. And how did you know those cops in the basement? What is going on?"
Sebastian sits there like a child being scolded. It's like he can't even bear to look at her. Behind them, Allen Ginsberg has now found his way to this church. He walks quietly in and goes from tired body to tired body, blessing people in their sleep and placing his hand on the heads of the conscious and saying, Hare Rama, Hare Krishna, and shaking his head the way he does so his beard looks like a tight shivering mammal. A month ago, a Ginsberg appearance would have drawn a lot of attention. Now he's become part of the scenery of the protest, one of the protest's many colors. He walks around and the kids give him weary, exhausted smiles. He blesses them and moves on.
Are you working for the police? Faye asks.
No, I'm not, Sebastian says. He leans forward, clasps his hands as if in prayer.
More like with the police. It's nothing official. Actually, I'm not even working with them. It's more like we work alongside each other. We have a certain understanding, a certain accommodating relationship. We both understand a few simple facts.
Which are what?
Primarily that we need each other.
You and the police?
Yes, the police need me.
The police love me.
What happened out there today,
Faye says, did not look like love.
I provide heat, drama. The police want reasons to crack down on the radical left. I supply those reasons. I print that we're going to kidnap delegates or spike the drinking water or bomb the amphitheater, and it makes us look like terrorists, which is exactly what the police want.
So they can do what they did tonight, gas us and beat us up.
In front of the TV cameras with people cheering them on at home, yes. Faye shakes her head.
But why help them? Why encourage all this?
She waves her hand around at the bloodied youths now occupying the sanctuary.
All this madness, this violence.
Because the more the police crack down, Sebastian says, the stronger our side looks.
Our side.
The protest movement, he says. The more the cops beat us up, the more our argument seems correct. He leans back into the pew and stares blankly forward.
It's actually pretty brilliant. The protesters and the police, the progressives and the authoritarians, they require each other. They create each other because they need an opponent to demonize. The best way to feel like you really belong to a group is to invent another group to hate. Which is why today was fantastic, from an advertising standpoint.
Behind them, Ginsberg is walking up and down the many pews of St. Peter's, quietly blessing those who are sleeping there. Faye can hear his monotonous voice singing Hindu songs of praise. She and Sebastian stare at the altarpiece, the saints and angels in stone. She does not know what to think about him. She feels betrayed. Or maybe more accurately, she feels like she should feel betrayed. She has never thought of herself as part of Sebastian's movement, but there are many people who do, and so she tries to feel betrayed on their behalf.
Faye, listen, Sebastian says.
He puts his elbows on his knees, breathes heavily, and looks at the floor.
That's not entirely the truth. The truth is, I couldn't go to Vietnam.
The lights in the sanctuary are dimming now. The trickle of protesters through the front door has stopped. All over, people fall asleep in twos and threes and fours. Soon the church is lit only by candles on the altar, a soft orange glow. I told everyone I was in India this summer, Sebastian says, but I wasn't. I was in Georgia, at boot camp. They were going to send me to Vietnam until a guy came offering this deal. An official at the mayor's office, who could pull some serious strings. He said, print these certain kinds of stories and we'll get you out of the army. I couldn't bear the thought of going to war. So I took the deal. He looks at Faye, his face pinched. I'm sure you hate me now, he says.
And yes, maybe she should hate him, but she feels herself softening to him instead.
They are, she realizes, not that unlike. My dad works at Chemstar, she says. Half the money that sent me to college came from making napalm. So I guess I'm in no position to judge.
He nods. We do what we have to do, right?
I probably would have taken the deal, too, Faye says.
They stare at the altar until a thought crosses Faye's mind.
So when you said you saw my mar,
Yes. You said you learned that word from Tibetan monks.
Yes.
While you were in India, but you weren't in India.
I read about that in National Geographic. It wasn't Tibetan monks. I think the article was about an Aboriginal tribe in Australia, now that I think about it.
What else have you lied to me about? Faye says. How about our date? Did you ever really want to go on our date?
Definitely, he says, smiling. That was the real me. I really wanted that. Promise. She nods, then shrugs.
How would I know?
But there's one more thing. Actually, one more little lie.
Okay.
It's not technically a lie I told you, per se. More like a generalized lie I told everyone.
Let's hear it.
Sebastian is not my real name. I made that up. Faye laughs.
She can't help it.
The day has been so ridiculous that it seems proper to add one more lunacy on top of it.
This is what you think of as a little lie? She says.
Call it a nom de guerre. I took it from Saint Sebastian, you know, the martyr. The police needed someone into whom they could shoot their arrows. I supplied that target. I thought it was apt. You don't even want to know my real name.
No, I don't. Not yet. Not right now.
Let's just say it's not a name that would rally the troops. Ginsburg has reached them now. He's crisscrossed the entire sanctuary, gone up and down all the pews, and he finally comes to them. He stands before them and nods. They nod back. The church is so quiet, all noise coming from the poet himself. His metal necklaces scratching and banging together, his murmurs and blessings. He places a hand on their heads, a soft, warm hand, a gentle touch. He closes his eyes and whispers something incomprehensible, like he's casting a secret spell on them. When he stops, he opens his eyes and removes his hands.
I just married you, he tells them. Now you're married.
And he shuffles off, humming quietly to himself. 34. Please don't tell anyone what I've told you, says the man she knows as Sebastian.
I won't, she says.
And she knows this is a promise she can keep, because she's never going to see any of these people again. She will, as of tomorrow, no longer live in Chicago, no longer study its circle. The knowledge of this has hardened around her during the day. She's not aware of having made a decision. It's more like the decision has been there all along. Already made for her. She does not belong here, and all that has happened in the last day proves it. Her plan is simple. She will leave at dawn. While everyone sleeps, she will slip out and leave. She will stop at her dorm. She will walk up to her room, and she will discover her door wide open, the lights on inside. She will find Alice sleeping in her bed. Faye will not wake her. She will tiptoe to her bedside table, very slowly open the bottom drawer and take out a few books and Henry's proposal letter. She'll quietly leave, stealing one last glance at Alice, who without her black sunglasses and combat boots looks human again, and gentle, and vulnerable, and even pretty. She will wish good things for her in life. Then Faye will leave. Alice will never even know she was there. Faye will catch the first bus back to Iowa. She'll stare at Henry's letter for about an hour before exhaustion finally takes her and she sleeps the rest of the way home. This is the plan. She will escape at first light. But that's still hours off. And here she is in Chicago with this boy in what is feeling like a moment outside time. The dark and quiet sanctuary. The glow of candlelight. She doesn't want to know Sebastian's real name because, she thinks, why ruin it? Why ruin the mystery? There's something delicious about his anonymity. He could be anyone. She could be anyone. She knows she will be gone tomorrow, but she is not yet gone. Tomorrow will be full of consequences, but this moment is consequence-free. Whatever happens right now will happen without repercussion. It feels delicious, being on the edge of abandonment. She can act without worry. She can do what she wants. What she wants is to take his hand and lead him into the shadows behind the altar. What she wants is to feel his warm body on hers. What she wants is to be impulsive like she was with Henry on the playground that night that seems a lifetime ago.
And even as she does this and presses her mouth to his, and he resists a little and whispers, "Are you sure?" And she smiles at him and says, "It's okay, we're married now." And they collapse on the tile floor together. She's aware that she's only partly doing this because she genuinely wants to. She's also doing this because she wants to prove something to herself. That she's changed. Because after you go through a trial by fire, aren't you supposed to come out a changed person? A different and better person? And this day was indeed trying, and she would prefer not to be the same person she was before, with the same petty worries and doubts. She wants to prove that she's gone through the terror of the day, and now she's stronger and better, even though she doesn't know if she really is. How can one tell when one becomes a stronger and better person? Through action, she decides. And so this is her action. She takes off his jacket, then hers. They sit yanking off their shoes and giggling, because there is no way to remove tight shoes in a matter that's sexy. This is her great demonstration to herself and to the world. She is changed. She is a woman. She is doing womanly things, and she is doing them fearlessly. She unbuckles his belt and slides down his pants until he is poking nicely out of them. And even the posters from her high school home economics class have no power over her now, because she can feel the grit on her skin. And this man's smell right now is a mixture of sweat and smoke and body musk and tear gas. And her feeling about this is that she wants to devour him, and he wants to devour her, and if she's really honest, it feels delicious and liberating rolling around dirty together on these sparkling, clean, and smooth floors. God's floors, where if she looks up, she can see the stone Jesus directly above her, his head hanging so that at this angle it seems like he's looking right back at her, her terrible God disapproving at what she's doing in his holy house. And she loves it. Loves that it's happening right here, and she knows that tomorrow she'll return to Iowa and return to being Faye. Old Faye. She'll come back to her real self like a soul that's been traveling outside its body. And she'll say no to college and yes to Henry, and she'll become a wife, a strange new creature who will keep locked within herself the knowledge of this night. She will never speak of it, even though she will think of it daily. She will wonder how she is capable of being such different people.